rushed inside, weapons drawn, voices booming off the walls. I felt like I couldn't breathe, couldn't think. This couldn't be real. "Look everywhere, any closet, any crawl space, anywhere a child could hide," an officer barked. Half-packed boxes littered the floor. It was obvious that Ruby had been preparing to leave before the world closed in. But nobody was home. "Where are my siblings?" I thought, desperate. Later that day, I sat with a detective in a brightly lit room, my hands trembling as I tried to process the whirlwind of events that had shattered my world. "So, Ruby had the youngest kids locked up at Jody's house?" I asked, swallowing hard against a lump in my throat. "Why had they taken them there?" The detective's eyes softened with sympathy, but his voice remained professional. "We're not sure. All I can tell you is that they're both safe now." "And you've arrested both Jody and my mother?" I asked, my voice cracking slightly. "Yes," he confirmed, his tone grave. "Jody first, then your mother, upon her return to Jody's property." He hesitated for a moment, as if weighing his words carefully. "Both women have been charged with multiple counts of aggravated child abuse, and they've been denied bail." "What does that mean? Aggravated?" I asked, my voice barely above a whisper, a part of me desperately wishing I could take back the question to remain in ignorance for just a moment longer. The detective leaned forward slightly, frowning. "Well," he began, his voice gentler now, "typically it involves repeated acts of abuse over time, showing a pattern of cruelty." He paused, gauging my reaction before continuing. "It can also include extreme neglect, confinement, or intentional infliction of serious physical harm on a child." Each word was a dagger, twisting deeper into my heart. "I'm so sorry, Sherry," the detective added softly, and I nodded, numb, unable to form words, wondering what kind of a monster could ever inflict that kind of suffering on a child. That night, alone in the silence of my room, I finally surrendered to the tsunami of emotions. Great, heaving sobs racked my body, each one releasing years of pent-up fear, uncertainty, and anguish. "It's over," I told myself, the words becoming a mantra in my mind. "Ruby will never touch them again. Jody will never touch them again." I repeated it over and over, willing myself to believe it, to internalize the truth of it. I drifted into an exhausted sleep, my mind and body drained. I had been so focused on this moment for so long that I had no roadmap for what came next. Healing, justice, rebuilding. There was still a long road ahead, I knew that. But that night, for the first time in longer than I could remember, I could sleep in peace. My siblings were finally safe. For now, that was enough. For now, it was everything. Chapter 44, Rings of Remembrance. DCFS had custody of all my siblings except Chad. I still didn't know exactly what Ruby and Jody had done to the youngest ones. No one really did at that point. I focused on the now and the knowledge that they were finally safe from harm, far away from Ruby and Jody. When they were first taken into custody, both Ruby and Jody played dumb, acting as though there must have been some terrible mistake. Ruby refused to speak during her first interview with police. Jody, on the other hand, played the role of the traumatized victim with haunting precision. She sat in the interrogation room, her eyes wide and brimming with manufactured disbelief, gently insisting that there had been a terrible misunderstanding. Her act was as transparent as it was sickening. After their initial processing, Ruby and Jody were relocated together from St. George to Purgatory Correctional Facility in Hurricane, Utah. The irony of the name wasn't lost on me as I tried to imagine their journey. Ruby later told Kevin that the 15-minute drive was spent in silence, saying she couldn't bear to speak to or even look at Jody. I can only imagine what thoughts might have been racing through Ruby's mind as she sat there, her hands cuffed, staring out the window. Did she think of her children, of the life she'd left behind? Or was she lost in the enormity of what she'd done, what she'd become? I can imagine the fear clawing at her insides, the desperation to wake up from this nightmare. But there was no waking up from this. This was Ruby's new reality. Our new reality. Kevin was brought in for interrogation shortly after Ruby's arrest, as the police tried to determine the circumstances surrounding the chain of events. He seemed unaware of the situation, telling police Ruby had called him to pick up the kids the day she was arrested, but he wasn't sure why. When asked about his family, Kevin admitted, "I haven't seen them for over a year. I've been separated from my wife and family. I have some problems." He said that Jody and Ruby shared a close relationship, that Jody had recognized his need for help, and that it was Ruby who had invited him to leave and take some space. Kevin said that he agreed with her decision, stating that the time apart had been exactly what he needed to confront his own addictions. "The space has been very, very good for me," he said, parroting Jody and Ruby's manipulative rhetoric. The disconnect between Kevin's calm demeanor and the reality of what had happened was staggering. But he was still living in an alternate universe, one in which he'd been brainwashed into believing that abandoning his family was somehow therapeutic. The police probed deeper, questioning Kevin's lack of knowledge about his children's living situation. He explained his role. "My job is to financially provide. I pay the bills with my job. I provide the money, which goes into a shared bank account." In the police raid on Jody's home that led to her arrest, investigators had found a stash of $85,000 in cash hidden in the house. Ruby had cleaned out not only the joint accounts she shared with Kevin, but also all her children's savings accounts, except mine. I'd already moved my money to a separate account in my name only. Kevin said the last time he'd seen Ruby was 5 days prior. She told him in light of their separation, she was looking for ways to make money and asked him to sign over the titles to the cars she drove and wanted his permission for vague investments she refused to elaborate on. What he didn't know was that Ruby wanted to sell the house and couldn't because Kevin's name was on the mortgage. He confessed that he would have signed anything Ruby put in front of him, no questions asked. Luckily, Ruby's arrest happened before she had a chance to put any paperwork in front of him and strip away the family's assets. Kevin still seemed confused as to why he had been called in for questioning until police painted a picture of what they suspected Ruby and Jody had done to my youngest siblings and the condition in which they had been found. Kevin was shocked, responding, "That sounds horrible, disgusting. No human being should be treated like that." The police informed Kevin that his children, aside from me and Chad, were now in the custody of DCFS and under a medical hold for 72 hours. Kevin became emotional, asking, "What's going to happen with my wife? I love my wife." He continued to express trust in Ruby, seemingly caught between loyalty to his wife and the shocking revelations about what she and Jody had done to their children. "I am completely misunderstood," Ruby said in her first call to Kevin directly after her arrest, expressing no remorse. "That is the most horrible feeling, like my own family misunderstands me. They misinterpret me. And poor Jody, they misinterpret her. They misunderstand her." She continued, her voice rising with emotion. "I mean, it's just horrendous. But you know what? Like Joseph Smith, every wonderful man of God has been misunderstood. I'm going to get out of this. Who knows? Maybe in 10 days I'll get out of this." Her words came faster now, as if she was caught up in a vision. "God spoke to me when I was driving, before I called you. The Spirit said, 'Your children are going to be removed.'" A long pause. "I'm committed to our family," Kevin said. "I'm committed to you and our marriage, no matter what happened." "Well, thank you for stepping up," was Ruby's reply. Amazingly, Ruby had expressed confusion as to why anyone would be concerned about the shocking state her youngest kids had been found in. "I don't understand why they're in the hospital. They're perfectly fine," she declared. The children were not fine. I knew that much. So did everyone who'd seen them. Paramedics, police, witnesses to the outcome of Jody's and my mother's acts of extraordinary cruelty. I asked the police if I could go into my house to gather some personal items that had not been confiscated as evidence. Journals, tablets, cell phones, and passports. And trinkets that I wanted to make sure were safe. Like the little brooch Kevin got me when he went to Italy, which I wanted to give to one of my kids one day. I walked in, accompanied by an officer, and looked around. I found one of Ruby's laptops and easily figured out her password to her Apple iCloud account. I read some text messages, emails, and journal entries in the Notes app that confirmed for me the truth about the nature of her relationship with Jody and how it had spilled over into the physical. Ruby, expressing her frustration about having to cater to Jody's needs for physical affection without getting anything in return. My mother? Servicing someone else? First time for everything. I didn't read on. What happened between them, romantically, was none of my business. I didn't care to know nor think about it any further. My eyes fixed on the door to the master bedroom, Ruby and Kevin's room. Before I could second-guess myself, I walked over and pushed the door open. It looked so normal, so unchanged, that for a moment I could almost pretend that nothing had happened. That any minute Ruby would walk in, complaining about the mess or lecturing about the importance of making beds. My eyes landed on Ruby's ornate jewelry box atop the dresser. Inside, nestled on velvet, lay the rings. Beautiful, sparkling testaments to the milestones of Ruby and Kevin's relationship. Anniversary gifts, birthday presents, spontaneous tokens of affection. Each one carefully chosen by Kevin. Each one a symbol of his love and commitment. I saw the first engagement ring he got her from the days when my parents were young and money was tight. It was very simple, a modest band with a tiny diamond. A few years ago, Kevin had surprised Ruby with an upgrade. A huge, glittering diamond surrounded by two thick silver bands. A gesture of his unconditional love for the wife he thought he knew. Was it possible that all the love, all the attraction had been one-sided? A current flowing from Kevin to Ruby, never quite making the return journey? If Ruby had never truly loved Kevin, what did that make me? The product of a false love, a union where Ruby saw in Kevin not a partner to cherish, but a means to an end? A sperm donor and a sidekick in her grand plans? Almost without thinking, I slid both bands onto my own fingers. Ruby didn't deserve those rings, not after what she'd done. I stared at my hand, making a silent vow of eternal remembrance. I will never forget what you did, Ruby, I promised myself, staring hard at the bands on my fingers. I understand the fickle nature of memory, how our minds can sometimes erase the most painful experiences, leaving behind a sanitized version of the past. But I couldn't afford that luxury. I needed to remember, to hold on to the harsh reality of what happened, of what she did to our family. Those rings weren't just jewelry, they were anchors, tethering me to a past I couldn't allow myself to forget. When I slip those rings onto my finger, it's not out of nostalgia or lingering affection for Ruby. They're not mementos of happier times or symbols of a mother's love. No, these rings serve a far more crucial purpose. They're a contract I've made with myself, a constant reminder cast in metal. With those rings, I bind myself to the truth. Chapter 45. Evidence in Plain Sight. Kevin was furious when he found out that I'd gone home and taken those journals, tablets, cell phones, and everyone's passports from the house, even though I was accompanied by the police. He was still so ill, so brainwashed back then, still loyal to Ruby and Jody above all. Kevin told the cops they should charge me with burglary, and they pretty much laughed in his face, pointing out that I had just as much right to retrieve items from the family home as he did. Kevin was displeased with this answer and advised we would be hearing from his attorney, an officer wrote in his report. I felt sorry for Kevin more than anything. I gave the items back to the cops, and they returned everything to Kevin. I didn't focus on it too much at the time. For now, there were more pressing issues at hand, ensuring that justice would be served. At first, Ruby spoke out in Jody's defense, but that loyalty quickly dissolved when she realized she could improve her own situation by turning against her friend. By pleading guilty and agreeing to testify against Jody, Ruby could paint herself as a victim of Jody's manipulative influence during the abuse of my siblings. With Utah's current push for justice reform emphasizing rehabilitation over punishment, Ruby's strategy was clear: show remorse, keep a low profile, and hope for an early release on good behavior. Ruby's guilty plea to 4 counts of aggravated child abuse with consecutive sentencing meant a maximum of 30 years under Utah law and possibly as little as 4 years. Adding more charges wouldn't have increased her potential sentence. It was infuriating to think that Ruby's manipulative tactics could lead to a shortened sentence, despite the unimaginable suffering she'd inflicted on my siblings. After Ruby's arrest, an unexpected emotional storm hit me. At first, I couldn't make sense of it. It wasn't until I sat down with Dana, my therapist, that I began to unravel the complex emotions I was experiencing. Alongside the horror I felt toward my mother's actions, I found myself drowning in a tidal wave of guilt and self-loathing, all stemming from what had happened with Derek. The sense that I was a homewrecker, a fundamentally bad person, overwhelmed me to the point where I questioned my will to live. "Why am I thinking about Derek now?" I asked Dana, tears streaming down my face. "It's over. It's been over for months. I don't know what to do. I can't handle these feelings, not on top of everything else." Ruby had implanted in me very effective mechanisms for intense guilt, shame, and self-loathing. The situation with Derek was the first real-world instance where I faced the repercussions of this conditioning. Understanding this connection was crucial. My experience with Derek was the first example of how my inner critic could lead me to a dangerous mental state, fraught with anxiety, panic attacks, and self-blame, a state that, for many, can lead to suicidal thoughts. As Dana and I peeled back the layers, we realized that addressing what had happened with Derek was crucial before we could even begin to unpack the complex layers of my upbringing with Ruby. How could I hope to understand 20 years of Ruby's influence if I couldn't make sense of what had happened over the past 2 years with Derek? The guilt I felt was so intense, so all-encompassing, that it was becoming a barrier to addressing anything else. I had once believed that as soon as Ruby was out of my life, the negative voices in my head would eventually disappear. But they were still steering the ship. I was overwhelmed and unable to process what was happening. I would need to learn new tools to recognize and manage my intense emotions if I ever hoped to truly reclaim my narrative and my life. In early December 2023, Ruby called Chad from prison. As fate would have it, I was with him at the time. With a grim nod, he answered and put the call on speakerphone, allowing me to bear witness. Ruby's voice, once commanding and self-assured, now came through in hushed, almost reverent tones. She spoke of her recent deep dives into scripture, desperately searching for meaning in her current circumstances. "I was reading in Doctrine and Covenants," she said, referencing one of our church's foundational texts. "Christ had a bitter cup he didn't want to drink, but he did because that was his mission. I'm drinking my bitter cup now." There she was again, Ruby, fallen family vlogger, comparing herself to Christ on the cross. And in her narrative, the rest of the world was cast as the Romans, cruel persecutors forcing her to drink vinegar. Chad and I locked eyes, mine wide with disbelief, his dark with disgust. The delusion was breathtaking. Comparing her suffering to that of the Savior? It was a breathtaking display of narcissism. A twisting of faith so profound it bordered on blasphemy. Publicly, though, Ruby's narrative had shifted dramatically to one of humility and contrition. Likely on the advice of her legal team, she began describing her arrest as the strangest and most miraculous intervention. She claimed that being separated from Jody had brought her clarity. "I'm not hearing her, and I think not hearing her has cleared a lot of things up for me." Ruby started emphasizing her own susceptibility to Jody's influence. "How gullible was I? Oh my gosh, how much power I gave this person, and I didn't see it." However, Ruby had already pleaded guilty to severely abusing the children by this point. Her claims of being under Jody's spell could only explain so much of her actions. The truth remained that she had actively participated in the abuse of my siblings, and no amount of revisionist history could erase that fact. Ruby should not be allowed to manipulate the legal system into an early release and paint herself as solely a victim of Jody's manipulation. She was a malignant narcissist who needed proper psychological help and rehabilitation if she was ever going to be able to safely re-enter society. The evidence of her pre-existing abuse was already out there, online, in the form of 1,300 8-passengers videos she'd made during her 7 years of vlogging. Alongside all the other evidence, those videos would surely provide proof that Ruby had utilized harsh and excessive discipline against her children long before Jody came on the scene. I took it upon myself to create a compendium of those videos so that the prosecution could more fully understand the person they were dealing with. That, for me, Ruby had always been an abuser. The thought of going through more than 1,000 videos was overwhelming, so I posted a story on Instagram inviting people to DM me questionable or concerning clips from Ruby's old videos. The response was immediate, supportive, and enthusiastic, so much so I started a Google Doc where people could post links. I felt stronger knowing I wasn't in this alone. Within about 6 hours, the Google Doc was filled with dozens of links to video footage showing Ruby being Ruby, showing her taking away the kids' bedrooms, withholding food as punishment, canceling Christmas for the youngest kids for being selfish. What an ironic reversal. The woman obsessed with sharing her most intimate family moments online in exchange for fame and money was about to be exposed by those same videos. Evidence of her sins, proof of her mean and bizarre parenting philosophies. And then, of course, there was the Connections classroom. Hours upon hours of footage showcasing Ruby and Jody preaching their dangerous ideology. Their obsession with pain, their vitriol against children and those struggling with mental health issues. Their strange and unyielding manifesto was laid bare, word for word, straight from the source. The harsh reality of her situation was finally sinking in for Ruby. Even in a prison population filled with women accused of heinous crimes like murder and assault, Ruby quickly realized that convicted child abusers were considered the lowest of the low. In a letter to Kevin, her fear was palpable. She confessed her terror of being attacked, writing that she was constantly on edge, afraid she might be shanked at any moment. Ruby described a delicate balancing act, learning to keep her head down while not allowing herself to be perceived as weak or vulnerable. As I read about her struggles, I felt a confusing mix of emotions. Part of me couldn't help but worry for her safety, despite everything she had done. The thought of anyone, even Ruby, living in constant fear was unsettling. But another part of me, the part still raw from the pain she had inflicted on our family, whispered a harsh truth. Ruby, you did this to yourself. Chapter 46. Home Sweet Home. Kevin had moved back into our house permanently. Every night, he slept alone in his too big bed in his too quiet house, haunted by if-onlys, caught in an endless feedback loop of his own failures, the warning signs he overlooked, the moments he could have been braver, stronger, better. But the past can't be unwritten. It can only be reckoned with, learned from, one brutal day at a time. He had been making huge strides mentally and was in therapy, as was I, as we learned to stand side by side again as imperfect partners in recovery from what happened. I could tell he was trying to make things better, to repair his relationship with his kids, to prepare the home for the kids' eventual return. He'd have to prove to the authorities, of course, that he was responsible enough to be their father again, and that would take time. For now, he was trying his best to turn Ruby's house into a home. The first thing he did was get two new puppies, a Cavapoo named Wren and a Bernedoodle called Stimpy. He'd emptied out Ruby's pantry, keeping only the freeze-dried food, buckets of flour, and rice. All the canned goods got donated, except for the cans expired by 5 years. We had fun trashing those. As long as we have enough to feed us for a few months, that's all we need, he said. The rest is just clutter. As he cleansed the house of its past under Ruby's dominion, he told us that once everyone was home again, we could decorate our rooms however we want. I don't care anymore. Make it your own space, he said. And hey, you know what? You can all have TVs in your rooms, too. Sure, the house was messier, but it felt lived in. Shoes in the house? No problem. Animals on the couch? Kevin didn't bat an eye. I was living in my own one-bedroom apartment near campus, no roomies this time, completing my final year of school. I'd begun to push back against that ingrained minimalism taught to me by Ruby. A few carefully selected photos, my senior portraits, were taped to the walls, tentative steps toward self-expression, toward making my space truly my own and inhabiting my world on my own terms. Still, until the kids were back home, there was no way I could even begin to relax. That Christmas of 2023, it was just Kevin and me in the house, both of us feeling depressed that the seven of us couldn't be together as a family for the holidays. Not yet. We were sitting on the couch when he suddenly turned to me. You know, I've always wanted to get a cat, he mused. I perked up. Really? Me too. Before I knew it, we were in the car, heading to look at some kittens from a local ad. That's how we ended up with Katniss, Kevin's cat, and Muppet, who would be mine, my son in cat form. I brought him home and settled into life with my chaotic little tornado of mayhem. Muppet was literally bouncing off the walls 24/7, landing on my head during Zoom calls, climbing my hair, only to pass out on my computer keyboard, purring, as soon as it was time for me to do homework. Now that I was a parent, albeit to a feline, I found it even more impossible to understand what Ruby and Jody meant about the hardships of motherhood, the dangers of putting the needs of a little bundle of joy above your own. The thing I liked most about Muppet was that he, like all cats, is utterly immune to any form of discipline. Obedience? Forget about it. I could only imagine trying to explain to Muppet that his lust for Cheez-Its was distorted and that he was going to be damned. No, my furball was on his own unique life path, and I was honored to witness him and his frankly bizarre and mystifying choices, and provide whatever snacks he needs along the way. One thing is for sure, I had no intention of putting him on YouTube and monetizing our little party of two. Nope, Sherry and Muppet's special moments would be just for us and us alone. Chapter 47, Judgment Day. Journal. As much as I don't love the woman, Ruby is my mother and deserves a free and fair trial. I'm devastated I don't get privacy in any of this, but that's been my life for a long time. On Tuesday, February 20th, 2024, the day of my mother's sentencing, I found myself waking up in St. George, having made the four-hour journey down with Kevin and Chad the previous day. As the miles stretched out before us, Kevin and I engaged in an intense discussion about the current legal situation, while Chad remained engrossed in his phone in the back seat. Some things never change. Conversation focused on what the next steps would be for getting restitution from Jody. We had learned that she had listed her house on the market for $5.3 million, and we were convinced that she was attempting to dispose of her assets in a desperate bid to prevent them from being seized by the courts. The thought of Jody evading financial responsibility for the harm she had inflicted on the children was unthinkable, and our lawyer was working to secure a restraining order that would prevent her from liquidating her assets until a fair and just allocation of restitution and reparations could be made for the children, providing the necessary resources for their ongoing mental health treatment and support. We arrived in St. George and had a strangely normal evening, the three of us getting Indian food and watching basketball. It was almost like old times, a fleeting glimpse of the life we once knew, a reminder that beneath the pain and trauma, the bonds that connected us were still there. Kevin wasn't a pod person anymore. There was a lot more work to do, a lot more healing to happen for all of us. But for now, we were united in the same cause, making sure justice was served and the children's futures protected. The next morning, we met up with a prosecutor and a victim's advocate who walked us through what to expect in court. The judge was almost certain to hand down the agreed-upon sentence, but still, my stomach churned as we made our way to the courthouse, slipping in a side door to avoid the media. I kept my head down and put one foot in front of the other, willing myself not to trip. I couldn't wait for the day there weren't cameras in my face, capturing my worst and most tender moments. To my relief, the media presence outside the courthouse was mercifully minimal. Thank goodness, a reprieve from the circus. When Chad, Kevin, and I walked into the courtroom, I immediately realized why there had been no media outside. They were all in there, waiting for us. Every head in the room swiveled in our direction, a sea of curious eyes fixed upon us. We took our seats in the front row, the leather creaking beneath us as we settled in, waiting for the proceedings to begin. "All rise for the honorable judge," the bailiff's voice rang out as the judge entered the courtroom. Moments later, Ruby was led in, her wrists and ankles shackled. Her prison jumpsuit seemed to hang off her frame. I couldn't bear to look at her. My heart was hard. I was filled with disgust. I fixed my gaze upon the judge. Ruby delivered her statement, painting herself as the ultimate victim, how she'd been deceived for so long, almost as if she had been an unwitting participant in the abuse. Then, in a tone better suited to a Grammy acceptance speech, she launched into a laundry list of thank yous to every officer, lawyer, and judge who had snatched her out of a hell she didn't know how to get out of. "Are you sure, Ruby?" I silently questioned. The preposterous notion that she had been trapped, helpless to escape the nightmare she had willingly perpetuated, was an insult to the court and to the world. Ruby declared that the moment of her arrest was the moment she gained her freedom. Then she turned her attention to Kevin. "You're the love of my life," she said, and I watched as Kevin bowed his head, his shoulders shaking with the weight of emotions he could not hold back. After thanking everyone and their dog, Ruby finally turned her attention to me and my siblings. She didn't use our names, instead referring to us as her six little chicks and herself as our mama duck who had been dragged into a current while trying to lead us to safety. Not once did she acknowledge having been anything less than Mother of the Year before Jody entered our lives. There would be no apology for the years of torment and exploitation that preceded Jody. Listening to her hollow words, I wondered if, in her narcissistic mind, Ruby would ever fully comprehend the gravity of her actions or experience genuine remorse. A memory popped into my head from when I was 12 years old, right before Ruby launched 8 Passengers. I had forced Ruby and Kevin to endure my 3-hour stage adaptation of Frozen, starring myself and my siblings, written and directed by me, in our living room. The part of me that was still that little girl, longing for her mom's love and approval, suddenly wondered if maybe Ruby, like Elsa, the Ice Queen, could travel up the mountain of the Utah prison system for a few years and up there just let it go. Let go of the curse of control. Let go of coldness. Let go of lies. Let it all go until one day she would come down the mountain a different person, one who understood the meaning of love. Reality quickly snapped me back to the present. I was no longer a little girl, and Ruby was no Disney princess. She was an adult who had made a conscious choice to inflict unspeakable harm upon those she was meant to protect. And now she would face the consequences of her actions. 4 sentences of 4 to 15 years to be served consecutively as delivered by the court. As Ruby was led away, I realized I, too, would have to learn to let it go. That wouldn't mean forgetting or excusing what had happened. It would mean allowing myself to feel, to be imperfect, to love myself and others without judgment. It would mean breaking the cycles of fear and control that had been passed down to me. It would mean recognizing my power, facing my fears, and always choosing love over fear again and again. I reached out and grabbed Kevin's hand. Having sought guidance from Jesus, forgiving him had emerged as the right choice. I would never forget the pain he had caused, ignored, and enabled. He had not been absolved, but I had chosen to release the burden of resentment I held against him. In extending a hand of compassion and understanding, I was granting myself the freedom to heal. Next, Jody was escorted into the courtroom. I chose to look directly at her face. Gone was the meticulously coiffed hair that had once been her signature. It now hung limp and greasy, framing her ashen skin. She kept her gaze resolutely trained ahead, never once making eye contact with anyone in the room, as if by avoiding our eyes, she could somehow escape the weight of her actions. As the judge rehashed the plea agreement, Jody's lawyer tried to argue that there were 2 sides to every story, prompting the judge, clearly incensed by the audacity of the statement, to demand what other side there could possibly be to the torture of children. Jody had been making phone calls from jail to her followers, painting herself as a prophet wrongly persecuted, God's messenger behind bars, comparing herself to Joseph Smith, the founder of my faith, saying things like, "God speaks directly to me." The sheer arrogance and delusion of her statements left me in no doubt. Jody was entirely unrepentant. I had assumed that Jody would remain silent, but to my surprise, she stood up to deliver a statement, only a few brief sentences. "I loved those children," she began, and as soon as the words left her mouth, Chad and I locked eyes, a shared sense of incredulity passing between us. Then she wished the children beautiful, happy lives, showing zero remorse or accountability. The judge, however, was not swayed by Jody's empty words. He hadn't made any comment before passing sentence on Ruby, but he did this time, speaking of how adults, especially those with specialized training, have a sacred duty to protect vulnerable children, and that Jody had done the opposite, terrorizing those in her care. He deemed her so far detached from reality, common sense, and decency that consecutive sentences were the only appropriate response. It was validating, hearing the disdain in his voice, the confirmation that Jody was no innocent bystander, but an active perpetrator of unspeakable horrors. She got 4 to 30 years, the same as Ruby. As Jody was led out in cuffs, reality sank in. We had won. The monsters had been caged. For how long, who knew? That would be up to the parole board. But at the very minimum, they would be inside for 4 years. As soon as a gavel banged, Chad, Kevin, and I bolted for the side exit, desperate to avoid the inevitable onslaught of cameras and reporters. Our hopes were dashed as soon as we pushed open the heavy metal door and stepped out into the sunlight. A pack of reporters lay in wait, their hungry eyes fixed upon us, their cameras and microphones at the ready. They descended upon us like vultures, shouting questions that echoed across the manicured lawn as we made a mad dash for the parking lot. "Sherry, do you have a comment?" one reporter called out, thrusting a microphone in my direction. "No comment," I replied, quickening my pace. The reporter persisted, undeterred by my curt response. "Kevin, did you know this abuse was happening?" "No comment," Kevin echoed, his jaw clenched. "I understand," the reporter continued, her tone dripping with false empathy. "Chad, any remarks?" Chad, his patience wearing thin, turned to face the reporter and threw her one of his famously withering stares. "I don't think you understand any of this at all, do you?" he said. And with that, she finally shut up. Shell-shocked and emotionally spent, we climbed into the car, each of us lost in our own thoughts as we drove through the streets of St. George. Then we did the only thing we could think to do. We drove to Cafe Rio in St. George, ordered 3 burritos with a side of guacamole, and talked about nothing in particular. Chapter 48, Ruby's Journal. All I had wanted for so long was for the world to just sit up and listen, to understand that Ruby and Jody needed to be stopped. But once they did, it seemed like people couldn't get enough. Again, thanks to Ruby, our lives were no longer our own. Media outlets in the United States and all over the world immediately picked up the story of the holier-than-thou YouTube mommy blogger who'd been arrested on charges of child abuse alongside her best friend. The story had all the ingredients. A beautiful, God-fearing American family turning their rags into riches on YouTube, only to be wrenched apart in a dramatic turn of events featuring demon possession, doomsday prepper cults with lesbian undertones. Those who had been following our family for years felt vindicated as the rest of the known universe finally woke up to what had been happening behind Ruby's white picket fence. In a way, we represented the first true, damning proof of how badly things can go wrong in a social media-driven world where kids are content and content is king. A few weeks after Ruby's sentencing, the Washington County Attorney's Office released the evidence to the public, and with that, my nightmare was about to worsen. Because amid the photographs, documents, and digital files were my mother's handwritten journals, documenting in cold and horrible detail what had happened when she'd taken my 2 youngest siblings from our Springville house to live with Jody, leaving my middle sisters behind. How for those 3 months, Ruby and Jody had been putting my youngest siblings through a twisted training program in the name of purging the evil from them through a system of daily punishments. Without reading them, I knew those sickening journals chronicled, right there in my mother's cursive, exactly how Ruby and Jody had morphed into the very demons they claimed to be purging from my siblings' souls, twisted fiends who tortured little children, like something out of a grotesque Hieronymus Bosch painting. I never wanted to read it. I never wanted to know the details. And when the authorities released my mother's journal, my world stopped spinning for a moment. There it was, laid bare for all to see. 60 pages of horror, and I refused to look. I knew it was bad. My imagination was filling in the gaps, and sometimes that's worse than knowing. But I couldn't. I wouldn't read those pages. I didn't need to read it to know what had happened. "I'm sorry," I thought, imagining my youngest siblings trapped in that nightmare. "I'm so, so sorry. I wish I could have done more. I wish I could have taken away your pain. And everyone else, please, just stop. Let them heal in peace. Let us all heal." But everyone was talking about it. The news, social media, even people on the street, dissecting every detail, feeding this true crime circus. Didn't they understand? These are children, my siblings. real people who have suffered unimaginable horrors. It's not entertainment. It's not a story to be picked apart and analyzed. I wanted to scream at them all to stop, to leave it alone. Some things should remain unspoken. Some horrors should be left in the dark where they belong. This was one of them. The day the evidence was released, I sat with Kevin and Chad, cameras pointed at us. We were about to watch the 2020 episode called Ruby Frankie, From Momfluencer to Felon. Surreally, we were watching it in front of a documentary crew that was filming us, making their own film about our family. I hated this, cameras on us again. But we'd all agreed that we had to take control of the narrative somehow. And that's why we'd decided to allow these highly reputable filmmakers in, if only to help us set the story straight before moving on with our lives. As the 2020 episode began, I felt a knot form in my stomach. The room fell silent as images flashed across the screen. Suddenly, without warning, pictures of the kids' injuries appeared. I felt the air leave my lungs. None of us had seen the photos yet. Kevin reached out, squeezing my hand. Chad stared at the floor. I couldn't stand it. Jody's face appeared on screen, and I felt a wave of disgust wash over me. Seeing Ruby's face, I felt numb. I didn't know who this person was anymore. I hated 2020's approach. It didn't feel emotionally sensitive or appropriate in tone. I didn't think they had any other motive rather than to make a popular documentary and capitalize on a shocking news story. I wondered how the public's consumption of others' pain and suffering crossed the line from empathy to voyeurism. How quickly have we, as a society, become numb to the struggles of others, our capacity for compassion eroded by the sheer volume of human drama we're exposed to daily? We were just characters in a soap opera now, except the drama was real and the consequences permanent. Our grief had been reduced to a mere commodity, packaged and sold, consumed and discarded. For content creators, news outlets, and true crime documentarians alike, the rewards of this emotional economy can be seductive. And the digital and media landscape remains vast and full of promise. But it is also a wilderness, and I fear we have lost our way. I knew I had to make a stand somehow. Part of that would be saying no to the world's desire for me to talk about my siblings anywhere, even in the pages of my own book. It is up to my brothers and sisters if they wish to share their story one day, but I'd be no better than Ruby if I detailed their experiences without their consent. They deserve to be given back the choice that had been stolen from them for so long. I don't want to be anything like her, I thought. I won't exploit them the way she did. Chapter 49. It Ends Here. In August 2024, I received a letter from Ruby in prison. Her lawyer passed it on to me, explaining that Ruby had written it months before, in February, but it had gotten lost in the shuffle of legal paperwork. Reading my mother's words brought on a strange mix of emotions. It was 5 pages long, but its length didn't equate to substance. 2 entire pages, for instance, were devoted to describing my nursery. Ruby waxed poetic about the excitement of preparing for her firstborn, the care she took in choosing colors and decorations. She spoke of me as her baby, her words dripping with nostalgia for a time long past. But reading it felt like looking through a stranger's photo album. I recognized the characters, but I couldn't connect with the emotions being described. The letter did contain an apology. Not for any of the things I might have expected or hoped for. She didn't say sorry for the pain she'd caused us, nor did she acknowledge the reason she was in prison. Instead, Ruby expressed regret for not spending more time with me before I moved out before college. It felt like such a small thing to fixate upon in the grand scheme of our history. As I read, I found myself growing increasingly detached. The Ruby who wrote this letter seemed to exist in a delusional reality. One where our relationship could be mended with reminiscences about baby blankets and wall colors. She appeared to be reaching back to a time before the hurt, before the cameras, before everything went wrong. But she was still sidestepping the very real and painful issues that had driven us apart. In the end, the letter merely reinforced my opinion of Ruby. Even now, behind bars, she still couldn't, or wouldn't, acknowledge the deeper wounds, the years of emotional manipulation the public exploitation of our family life, the shocking harm inflicted on my youngest siblings. The question was, why? Narcissism has become somewhat of a buzzword lately. Got a self-centered boss? Narcissist. That friend who always makes it about them? Narcissist. That relative who dominates every family gathering? Narcissist. But not every self-centered act is a sign of a personality disorder. Sometimes people are just having a bad day, or maybe they're just garden variety jerks. True narcissistic personality disorder, NPD, is a complex and serious condition that goes far beyond being self-centered or difficult. It's a pervasive pattern of grandiosity, need for admiration, and lack of empathy that can cause significant problems in many areas of the disordered person's life. In the world of someone with narcissistic personality disorder, NPD, the universe doesn't just revolve around you. You are the universe. It's not a conscious choice, but rather the only way your psyche can function. Your mind is a fortress built to protect an incredibly fragile sense of self. For Ruby, narcissism wasn't a choice. It was survival, as instinctive and necessary as breathing. Just as my fawning response was my shield against the world, her grandiosity was her armor. Two different strategies, both born from the same soil of trauma and insecurity. Imagine, if you will, the exhausting mental gymnastics going on inside the mind of someone with NPD. It's a relentless, contradictory monologue. I'm special. I'm the best. But why doesn't everyone see it? They must be jealous or stupid. I need to show them how amazing I am. But what if they see through me? No, that's impossible. I'm perfect, aren't I? Of course I am. I have to be. This isn't just ego or self-centeredness. It's a desperate, all-consuming need to maintain an image of perfection, both to the world and to oneself. Any crack in this facade isn't just uncomfortable. It's existentially threatening. Understanding this doesn't excuse the behavior, but it does shed light on the profound suffering at its core. Extreme narcissistic behavior isn't about asserting superiority. It's about compensating for the fact that you feel fundamentally flawed and completely empty inside. Why some people develop these behaviors while others don't, I'm not sure. Ruby might have learned as a kid that being good and perfect was the only way to be loved. "But I'm a good girl," she cried to Kevin in the one and only phone call he had with her after her arrest. Whatever the cause, narcissism develops as a shield, a way to protect yourself from feelings of inadequacy or harm. The cruel irony is that this very shield, meant to safeguard the self, ultimately becomes a barrier to genuine connection and fulfillment. It's a fortress that keeps others out, but also traps the narcissist within. As for social media, for narcissists, it's like throwing gasoline on an already raging fire. Every like, share, and comment becomes a hit of validation, a momentary salve for that deep-seated insecurity. It's easy to see how it can become an all-consuming obsession, a digital stage for their never-ending performance of perfection. Learning about narcissism has helped me process the impact Ruby's had on my life. It doesn't excuse what she did, not by a long shot. But it reminds me that behind all that manipulation lay a deeply wounded person who never learned how to connect with others in a healthy way. Realizing your own mother was incapable of truly seeing you, of loving you for who you are, rather than as an extension of herself, is a bitter pill to swallow. It's the death of a fundamental childhood hope, the one where if you just try hard enough, mommy will love you unconditionally. But in a strange way, this understanding has also been incredibly liberating. I now know that I could never have been good enough or perfect enough to make Ruby truly happy or proud. The insatiable void I was trying to fill wasn't created by me, and it wasn't mine to fix. That realization, as painful as it is the first step on the path to healing. For me, if not for her. Sometimes I find myself tumbling down the rabbit hole of what-ifs. What if Ruby hadn't felt like motherhood was the only path to fulfillment? What if she'd been encouraged to explore all facets of herself beyond what her family told her was right for someone born a woman? Maybe if she'd had the chance to pour herself into a high-powered career in banking or physics, fields where empathy isn't exactly a priority, she wouldn't have seen her kids as employees and extensions of herself. Or maybe she wouldn't have had kids at all, it's impossible to know. But this mental gymnastics is crazy-making, and probably just another manifestation of my fawning nature. Always trying to solve the Ruby puzzle, searching for that magic key that would have made her happy and kind. The truth is, there probably isn't a magic key. Narcissism isn't a choice, it's a deep-rooted defense mechanism. And while it can be treated, it requires extensive and dedicated effort on the part of the narcissist themselves. There are a few self-aware narcissists out there on social media, and listening to them describe their true experience of the world is both fascinating and chilling. Their accounts of their feelings, or lack thereof, when it comes to the well-being of others, are a stark reminder of the fundamental disconnect at the heart of this disorder. So where does that leave us? How do we deal with the rubies of the world? How do we balance empathy for the wounded person behind the narcissistic mask while protecting ourselves and others from the damage they can cause? I don't have all the answers, but I do know that awareness is a start. Understanding that narcissism is a complex disorder, not just a label for selfish people, is crucial. And recognizing fawning as a trauma response, not just people-pleasing, is equally important. And while all that is happening, protecting the children, regulating or outright banning family vlogging for the questionable, exploitative practice that it is would be a great start. For me, understanding the patterns has been both heartbreaking and liberating. Seeing the pattern means you can break it. It's not easy, and some days it feels like I'm fighting against my own instincts. That urge to fawn, to sacrifice my well-being on the altar of others' comfort, still lurks in the shadows of my psyche. But every time I speak up instead of staying silent, every time I honor my own needs instead of burying them, every time I allow someone else to sit with their discomfort instead of rushing to smooth things over, I'm severing another link in that chain of generational trauma, that toxic relay race passing the baton of pain from one generation to the next. It must end here. It's not just about healing myself anymore. It's about creating a new legacy, a new pattern for the generations that come after me and my family. I am proud of my ancestors, and I want the generations that come to be proud of me too. That way, when we run into each other in heaven, we can look at one another and smile. And yes, I did consult my bishop about the possibility of encountering Ruby in the celestial afterlife, should she make it there somehow. He assured me I'm under no obligation to acknowledge or engage with her whatsoever. Small mercies, indeed. In the letters Ruby wrote to Kevin, letters that will forever go unanswered, she described sitting in her cell, crying the days away. And there have been moments, like on her birthday or Mother's Day, when the image of Ruby alone in her cell floods my mind and a wave of sadness washes over me. I do not wish suffering upon her. Rather, I desperately hope for her to find some kind of path toward redemption, if that's even possible. I heard she was trying to get a degree through the prison system, which is a positive step. She never finished college, after all, dropping out as soon as she married Kevin. She'll need to prepare herself, because the reality is that when she's released, whether that's in 10 years or when she's much older, she'll need to support herself. I don't have a desire to see her destitute. My hope is that she can use this time to educate herself, so that upon release, she can find a way to survive. Have a small house and a quiet life, far away from me. Perhaps by then, she will have found the courage to truly look within herself and begin the arduous journey of inner change. However, change was never something that came easily to my mother, if at all. At 43 years old, when she was arrested, she was still convinced that the world revolved around her. Now, with the facades stripped away, she's left with only the truth, the raw, unfiltered truth, as her sole companion. Could she possess the strength to confront her own reflection, to see herself for who she truly is? I hope so. As for Jody, I'll leave her diagnosis to the experts, and the fate of her soul to God. Epilogue. Seven Passengers. 1 year later. One Sunday morning, I kissed Muppet goodbye as he lounged on my bed, his newly acquired collar glinting in the sunlight streaming through the window. He looked up at me with those big, innocent eyes, and I scratched behind his ears, my heart swelling with love for this zany little creature who had become my anchor in the chaos. As I stepped out into the crisp Utah air, A flutter of nerves danced in my stomach, but this time they were the good kind. The kind that comes with anticipation, with the promise of something beautiful on the horizon. I was headed to a family dinner. No cameras rolling, no one telling us what to do or what to feel. Just us, together again. I slid into the driver's seat of my Ford Focus, the engine humming to life, and navigated the well-worn path to Springville. The gridded streets, the patches of green parks, so small against the backdrop of the mountains and the vast sky above. No matter where life took me, I knew a part of me would always belong to this little town nestled at the foot of the mountains. As I came off the highway into town, my phone buzzed with an incoming text. It was from my new bishop, the one who had become such a beacon of support since I'd left my old ward behind. He said Derek was being brought before a formal disciplinary council, his calling stripped away. A small victory, but not enough. Derek had never lost his temple recommend like I had. And the experience had taught me a vital lesson, that just because a church leader said something doesn't mean they're right, doesn't mean it's necessarily coming from God. With everything I'd gone through, I'd realized that what a human being says holds less value to me than my personal conversations with God. Those, now, are my North Star. I turned onto my street and saw the sprawling silhouette of my home. Sitting in the driveway, rusting away, our old Chevy van. Kevin had long ago removed the 8 passengers' license plate and the sticker. He wanted to sell it and get a truck for when the kids came back. We really didn't have a need for such a large vehicle anymore. I parked and walked toward the house, detecting the distinct smell of melted cheese and pepperoni as I reached for the doorknob. Was this really still my home after everything that had happened? I wasn't sure. But hearing the sound of laughter, I knew one thing with a fierce and sudden certainty. We were together, and that was the only place I wanted to be. I used to believe that every good thing I had in my life was thanks to Ruby. There are certainly some positive traits that stem from her. My fierce loyalty to my convictions, my knack for cleaning a bathroom until it sparkles. Yes, that's all Ruby, the echoes of her presence within me. But as I've gotten older, I've realized that the life I've created for myself and the person I've blossomed into are not because of Ruby, but in spite of her. For the first time in my life, I am genuinely happy. I've emerged from the cocoon of my past and somehow found the light. With the help of my community, endless therapy, and the healing power of mini corn dogs and powdered donuts, I'm slowly stitching my psyche back together, teaching my nervous system that it's safe to feel again, safe to rest. I'm learning to honor the grief, the rage, the riotous joy of reclaiming the autonomy stolen from that little girl, forced to smile emptily for a camera she never asked to be in front of. Yes, I still deal with the mental health consequences of my upbringing and all that's happened, but I can't help feeling proud of myself when I think about the strange odyssey I've been on in my short time on this earth. With each breath I take, I am reminded that I am alive, that I survived, and that I have the power to create a legacy of my own without YouTube. Oh, I took down my own channel and made all those years of content private, just for me and my family to enjoy. I felt no emotion, no sense of loss in doing that. In fact, it felt right. My focus is now turned toward the future, a blank canvas waiting to be painted. But this I know. I will break the cycle. I will trust the children, the child within me, and the children I will one day nurture. I will trust in their resilience, their wisdom, their limitless imagination, and their innate capacity for love. I will guide them, but I will also learn from them and allow their innocence and wonder to heal the wounded parts of my soul. Together, we will create a new story. Now that I have peace, this is my promise. Now that I have happiness, this is my purpose. Finally. Acknowledgements. I'm filled with gratitude for those who've helped bring this story to light. First and foremost, I'd like to thank Simon and Schuster for providing me the platform to share my truth, and my editor, Natasha Simons, whose thoughtfulness and understanding helped me navigate my fears and doubts throughout this difficult process. I'm forever grateful to Caroline Ryder, my writing collaborator, for putting to words the raw emotions and dialogue I've held close to my heart for years. This audiobook also wouldn't have been possible without Larry Shapiro, my manager and friend. Your unwavering support has been my anchor in turbulent times. I'm profoundly grateful for the love and encouragement given to me by Mom and Dad and all my other chosen family. Your support has been a beacon of hope, reminding me that family can be more than just blood. And last of all, I couldn't have written this book without the courage of my siblings and my father, Kevin. Thank you for your pure hearts and love. This book is a testament to our shared resilience and the unbreakable bonds between us, now and for eternity.
The House of My Mother, A Daughter's Quest for Freedom, was written and read by Sherry Frankie. It was recorded by Scott Wiley at June Audio Recording Studios in Provo, Utah. Editing, mix, and post-production by Danny Meltzer. Elisa Morales was the associate producer. The House of My Mother, A Daughter's Quest for Freedom, was directed and produced by Randy Dolnick. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The House of My Mother, A Daughter's Quest for Freedom, is available in print from Gallery Books.